The topics discussed here tonight are general in nature, and you should seek personal advice before acting on any of this information. And now, on 2GB 873, The Bottom Line. Thanks to IT Financial Services, high-quality financial planning. Visit itfs.com.au.
And Carly Tonkinson and Philip Tafe from IT Financial Services join me in the studio. They're authorised representatives of Apogee FP. We have to tell you that. How are you both?
Very well. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you.
You're looking all fit. You're still doing the cycling?
Philip? Yeah, too much of that.
Too much of that.
Yep.
Is it more fun in the winter or the summer?
For me, the summer, definitely. I mean, right. I know in Europe they ride in the snow, but that's not for me.
No. All right. And you've been on holidays, Carly?
No.
No, you've been suntanning? You found a bar with a skylight?
No. Just blushing, I guess.
Well, the summer's way behind us. The seasonal nature of investing, does it make any difference? Hot or cold, winter, summer?
Well, there are statistics and there's been a lot of studies on it that say yes. Realistically, I don't think people should be trying too hard to time these sort of things. Generally speaking, you know, it's about being invested for a long period of time in the stock market as opposed to trying to pick the perfect day or the perfect week or even the perfect month to invest. But it is pretty interesting when you have a look at it. If you look over several decades, for example, Mondays are statistically a bad day on the stock market. Reasons for this seem to be, there's a lot of bad news that people see coming through over the weekend and can't actually act on it because the market's not open. So potentially on Monday when the stock market opens, people
are keen to sell.
Well, yeah.
But for every sale, there's a buyer.
Well, indeed. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a sale.
Yeah, that's right. Doesn't that balance it? What you're saying is the prices go down on a Monday.
Well, they're staying statistically, yes. So more Mondays than not, we'll see a fall in the markets. But again, I mean, statistically, doesn't really mean much to you if you pick the wrong Monday to do your trading. So you should be a little cautious.
It doesn't mean you can profitably trade it either. Because I've seen some of these studies that show, there's this pattern that there are more Mondays that are down than other days. But to trade that profitably, you'd have to be trading big dollars over probably 50 years to actually generate some kind of meaningful profit from it. Therefore, you can't really trade the pattern. So, the whole seasonal investing, I'm not sure I really buy into it. I do remember one very popular morning TV program at one point telling all viewers to sell, sell, sell because the host thought, come September it was going to be just like it was, around September 11th, get out. And I remember, watching to see what happened because he said it so confidently and it didn't play out that way at all. And I think that's the problem with a lot of these predictions. No one really holds the predictor to account. No one goes back and says, hang on, you said on the Tuesday of September it was going to go down and it didn't and you lost me money. They just sound like interesting facts at the time.
Did they have a license, a certification for giving financial planning?
I don't know. I think it's probably worse if they do. If it's just somebody guessing and giving their opinion, they'd probably get away with it.
I want to know what I'd be up against if I had lots of money and I thought, I'm going to become a trader. I'm going to play with the stock exchange. Going to make some money out of this. But what am I up against? A lot of people act emotionally?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay,
yeah.
But what percentage of the investors are computers? They're simply told if it goes up by a certain amount, buy some, and if it drops by a certain amount, you better sell some.
A lot, and there's a lot of programs available, and a lot of people would have heard or maybe even attended seminars where, you go along and you pay $5,000-$6,000 for these computer programs that tell you when to buy and sell. In actual fact, these computer programs, a lot of them are pretty much known as a financial scam because, look, no computer can, all it can do is set parameters and tell you what to do. That's already inbuilt into the software. It's not going to take account of any changes. What you're really up against are professional investors, fund managers, so people moving big amounts of money, particularly in a market the size of Australia.
Yeah.
When you move these big amounts of money, it really does impact on the price. So as an individual investor, you kind of get dragged along with that, either dragged up or dragged down, just because of the amounts of money going into the market. And these are people, hopefully if they're doing their job well, that they're out there speaking to the company directors and researching very heavily. So this market should be the information should be readily available to the market. But whether or not an individual would really have access or even the time and the expertise to understand all the information out there to be making those decisions is, it would be pretty tough, I think.
Apart from individual stories like a bit of a scandal that causes a company's shares to drop, or they discover the cure for something and the shares go up, or they're selling milk products to China and the shares go through the roof, and you've got your wise after the event then. But haven't people put all these parameters into a computer, looking back to see what caused optimism, what caused pessimism, and then the computer keeps an eye on the news.
They do.
And then predicts what's going to happen tomorrow. Do they do this?
I don't know if it's a predictor. It's more reacting faster than anybody else to the announcement.
Yeah.
And to trade that cost effectively or profitably, you have to do it, it's within microseconds, to get ahead of the market.
Right.
If you buy that thing just a fraction of a second before anybody else knows about it, you can pick up some gains at the margin. But for your mum and dad investor out there, it's not going to work. Even if you were quicker than the quickest computers out, all around the world, you'd have to be trading such large volumes of money to profit on some of these movements. None of us can afford to do it.
Anyone with a lot of money can influence the market just by buying or selling.
Yeah. Of course.
If I had trillions or billions of dollars and I went out and bought Acme tractors or something, people say, wow, someone's put a lot of money into Acme tractors. Better hop aboard before it's out of sight.
And people do that.
And that changes the market, doesn't it?
We saw that with Blackmores recently.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably a really good example at the moment where investors are reacting to a piece of information on this whole free trade agreement. So Blackmores going into China, the price was up substantially. But we saw that come off a lot when Blackmores have come out and said actually they're not quite ready to meet that level of demand and they've come back a little bit. That's not to say that they won't make a success of it, but people can get a little bit carried away with these good news stories. And look, for every company that does really well out of this Chinese free trade agreement, there's going to be a lot of people that come back home with nothing, because just because you've gone over to China to negotiate doesn't mean you're going to come back with all these riches. So people need to be a little bit cautious, not get too overexcited at these latest trends.
A lot of investors also, you follow the best investors. What are they doing? Hear James Packer's buying into a company. Gee, let's follow him and do the same and hope he knows what he's doing.
Well, his father got out of shares just before the crash of 88.
Yeah.
Somehow he got wind of it. if he didn't cause it by getting out of the shares.
It could have been a bit of that. You hear a lot of these stories and I've heard a lot of the, stories about people who got out of everything right before the GFC. A lot of that has to be luck and whether or not people got out on the right day and whether or not people went back in on the right day as well. I mean, that's the other side of it. If you sold everything right before the GFC but never reinvested, you're probably not too happy with your returns in cash over the last 7 years. So I think, to expect one person knows more than everybody else, knows exactly what's going to happen, how long it's going to take and when you buy back in, to me, there's no exact science to it.
Are people justified in being rather scared of what they see in some places overseas that goes under the name of negative interest rates? Does this impact on your super, right?
It impacts on everything.
Wow.
I'm scared of negative interest rates.
I think it will impact for decades to come because, what governments are doing is lowering interest rates in a way that they're trying to stimulate borrowing, investment, get give their economies a kickstart. And what you tend to find is that kind of interference, it probably stops economies really hitting the depths of despair, but then it also tends to limit the upside as well.
Yeah.
And then also coming out the back end of a crisis where maybe it's protected a little bit, but it creates these artificial bubbles in different areas or asset classes because people have borrowed money at ridiculously cheap rates and speculated in areas that they shouldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a bumpier ride coming out the back end. So, like anything in life, for every benefit, there's a cost. Mm-hmm. And in this case, government interference. We get the benefit of hopefully short-term stabilisation of our economy, but longer-term, yeah, it'll potentially, if they don't manage it perfectly, and let's face it, which government ever manages it perfectly, you then get this bumpier ride coming out the back end.
But does it mean if I want to buy a house, they will pay me to borrow money from them and I don't have to pay them back for a long while?
Oh, in theory.
No more compound interest if it's negative interest rates.
In theory, but I wouldn't think it would work exactly like that. Because keep in mind that just because there's a negative interest rate, the banks aren't necessarily lending out. Like the same way we're paying around 4% on our mortgages, even though the cash rate's 1.75. So you've always got that difference between what individuals are paying for their borrowings. But, I mean, certainly you would think that there would be interest-free loans available in a negative interest rate environment.
Which certainly discourage people from putting money in a bank account. I think that's probably the bigger impact because you're basically paying for that privilege for the bank to hold on to the money.
Again, it does come back to security, though. And certainly, I mean, there's places where it's happening now that
you're paying
have
them
bank
to keep
deposits,
it secure.
And that's what the price of security
since real estate is a pretty good asset, you'd think the interest rate would be low if you're borrowing rather than to borrow to go to the races, where you'd be paying credit card rates, presumably. So the cash rate, what does that actually mean? Does that mean someone can borrow money at a very low interest and their collateral is even better than real estate?
So the cash rates that the RBA, so the Reserve Bank, sets, which is at 1.75 at the moment, generally that more relates to what the banks are borrowing the money for or lending money out for. So as an institution, not as into to Joe Bloggs buying a house. But it does, it affects the price of the money that the bank is getting. So if the bank is paying 1.75 for funding themselves, they'll on-lend that to you for 4-4.5%. That's their profit margin,
yes,
if you like.
Yes, yeah.
So that's the difference. But certainly when you go into, and that's, as you say, that's against a house. So that's a solid asset. Mm. If you're borrowing money to buy a boat or whatever it may be, you can expect that your interest rate is going to be higher. So the riskier the asset, the higher your rate's going to be. Yeah.
Wow. It's all very complex.
Can
to
be.
Those of us who haven't studied it. Like you.
To be honest, I think the more you study, the more complex it becomes. You realise there's a lot you don't know.
131873 is our number. If you have any questions about investments, about superannuation, about financial planning in general, 131873. This is 2GB in Sydney. It's 19 past 12. The bottom line, all about your personal finances and getting things into order with Kylie Tonkinson and Philip Tafe from our sponsors, IT Financial Services. Let's take some calls on 131873. Good morning, Jim.
Oh, morning, Brian.
Hi there.
I didn't mean to ring you up tonight, but you provoked me into it. I had the misfortune to listen to our politicians last night talking or avoiding talking about anything to do with money, economics or finance or Australia's debt. And it was just such a contrast to listen to your conversation with your guest and actually hear people talk sense about money. So I wanted to ask them, would you dedicate some of your time to trying to get into Malcolm Turnbull's ear or Bill Shorten's ear and just educate them a little bit about money, because they've obviously got no idea. So that's the compliment. The second thing was, you made a very good point, and I'm concerned that your listeners know about this, because there are lots of scams out there where people pushing computer software that they say will help you trade the markets profitably, and I thought you were unduly diplomatic in saying that some of them might be scams. I think I could prove to you beyond a shadow of a doubt that every last one of them is a scam.
I'm glad you're saying that, Jim, because I think we thought you were calling to say that, you know, you should get into this kind of software trading. We're a little bit worried.
We were ready for the for the conversation on that one, Jim.
Well, I had a very good piece of luck many years ago where I came from a computer background, and two guys that won, the survivor of them, won the Nobel Prize in pure maths for doing exactly that. You would know them, Professors Black and Scholes. You've probably heard of Black and Scholes. What they invented was something the world had been trying to prove for hundreds of years, was how to price an option.
All right.
And
yeah.
They finally used very advanced maths that I didn't understand, but they published their findings as scientists. They did that. and they wrote it in what is my first language. English is my second language. They wrote it in a language called BASIC. And the reason that's my first language, it only has 240 words in it. It's a computer language.
Yes.
So I just took their BASIC stuff, wrote it, and I did have something that could price options and nobody else did.
Mm.
And my first instinct was to sell it to the banks. And I did make a couple of calls, but I realised, well, I can't tell you why, because they weren't behaving particularly ethically in that area and I don't wish to defame them.
Mm.
So, but long story short, I just became a member of the stock exchange, went down there and traded it. And the top rule I had in my mind was make sure absolutely certain nobody else finds out about this, because I didn't want any competition.
Mm-hmm.
That's the test for it, and that's why you're absolutely right. Nobody who's got a real... Because if you've tested and you've made money, you're not going to tell anyone else.
That's exactly right, Jim. And look, that's the most logical way to think about it. You're right. If somebody can manipulate... Well, yeah, pick the market with a piece of software, they're certainly not wanting anybody else to have access to it. Why would you sell it?
There's out there, actually, that you touched on, and I think you might believe it's accurate. People are pushing if you get the fastest possible computer so that you can get to the market before anybody else.
Mm.
That clearly, once I became a member of the stock exchange and started trading this stuff, that occurred to me too. It's not right.
Mm.
You actually maximise your profit by letting the market move. In other words, if you buy it, you want to let it run a certain distance before you get out.
Yeah.
And by the way, the only strategy I've ever seen work on a statistical basis is a contrarian one. And René Rivkin was the first man I heard use that word, and I just observed it. I never practiced because I'm not a punter. I'm a bookie, if you want to use conventional language.
Mm.
But what a contrarian does, when the market goes up, you sell it. When the market goes down, you buy it. And you'd be right about 53% of the time.
Yeah, well, Warren Buffett, arguably the most successful investor, says exactly the same thing. So
I didn't know. I know a fair bit about Warren, but I didn't know that. I'm pleased to hear that
you
didn't come up with the opposite answer, because I'd be in trouble.
Well, you might wonder what to do.
But look, I'm deadly serious. You guys obviously care. You're relatively young people.
Thank you.
Try and help your country out by giving the advice in the area where you are clearly expert and thinking logically. Try and get some of that wisdom into our politicians, because Australia is $1.7 trillion net in foreign debt.
Mm.
And I don't know how we've survived. All I know is we're selling billions of dollars worth of assets, probably $50, $100 billion a year of assets into foreign ownership, like the Kidman Empire, which didn't complete, Port Darwin, you know all the things, the 28.4 billion of apartments that your very program, when Michael McLaren was there, he did that research, 28.4 billion dollars worth of apartments sold to the Chinese. And we're still going, even all those debts, reduce our net foreign debt, and yet our net foreign debt is increasing. And the source of, don't believe me, have a look at Catalogue 5302, which is the ABS balance of payments, which is Australia's accounts. And I'm not just, trying to praise you. I'm serious. I think people like yourselves that do understand money and profits and investing should give the country the benefit of your knowledge by somehow getting it into the politicians. Because if nobody does it, Australia's going to lose its sovereignty. China will buy every useful asset on this country, and they know the difference between the useful ones and the ones that are not. They leave us with the rubbish that makes no return, and they'll buy the means of production, like the dairy farm.
Yeah, look, a lot of it defies logic at the moment, Jim.
Okay, Jim.
Thank you.
Thanks for that.
Thank you.
27 past 12, 131873 is our number. I don't know if Jim has a financial advisor. I think he...
Sounds like he knows what he's doing.
Works it through from his own experience. Okay, with IT Financial Services, our sponsors, you can look forward to a brighter financial future. IT Financial Services work with you in partnership to help you achieve your goals and secure your financial future. For almost 30 years now, their advisors have helped thousands of people from all walks of life with everything from superannuation and investments to insurance and debt management. It's never too early to start your financial journey. Just make one call to IT Financial Services during business hours on Sydney 9258 7500, 9258 7500, or go to the website itfs.com.au and get started. You can go there, of course, anytime 24/7. IT Financial Services, Australia's own high-quality financial planning company, on 9258 7500. Bottom line, free financial advice, whatever your questions may be, 131873 is the number to call. Guess what? The lines are open now. 131873. Let's check the weather outlook for, Tuesday, that's today, May the 31st. It's going to be cool, with patchy fog in the outer west early this morning. Very high chance of showers about the coastal fringe, and a high chance of showers elsewhere. So cool and damp, temperature range 11 to 19 degrees, and in the west, an 80% chance of rain. Well, that's what I just said. Okay. Then the first day of winter, 13 to 18 degrees, with a 90% chance of rain. 12 to 19 on Thursday, with a 70% chance of rain, and cool, wet conditions for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So there you are. Actually, it'll be a bit warmer than the last week, even though we're moving into winter.
Yeah.
So it's all shuffling about. But we've got Mars very close to Earth, which really means very little, unless you're planning on a journey.
Not that
so. It's a bit late to tell you, because even though it's going to be very close this week, It's too far. Don't try it.
Still too far?
Bad investment. One-way ticket.
Think of the frequent flyer points.
Oh, yes. But you can't come back and cash them.
True.
It's a one-way ticket. And a whole lot of people want to give it a go. All right. Good luck to them. Now, this new $500,000 super cap, what does it mean? I've got $20,000 worth of super, if I'm lucky. I rang them up and said, how much have I got? They said, oh, $20,000. Can you put that in writing? They put it in writing. By the time the email got to me, it was down to 15,000.
Yeah, you said
that. Do super companies do this sort of thing?
That sounds quite unusual. Yeah. There's something, I would be checking a transaction statement if that's the case. Yeah.
Yeah, but those lucky people with half a million or up against the cap, this is not like the Parramatta cap on player payments. This
well, it is a little.
Just as serious if you breach it.
Oh, you won't reach the grand final. Do you make use of it sooner or later? How does this work?
So this was part of the new budget measures, is that they've introduced basically a lifetime cap on how much of your own money, so that's money out of your back pocket, you can add to your superannuation fund. So previously we had yearly limits that you can contribute, so that was the $180,000 a year or $540,000 in one go if you used the full 3 years at once. But what they did on budget night was said, okay, forget that. We'll now make it $500,000 lifetime cap. So once you reach the $500,000, that's it. You can't add any more of your own money in there.
Right.
But not only is that from now, we'll also count anything that you've done since July 2007. So this was quite a surprising measure. Usually, you know, there is a bit of an unwritten rule with these changes to superannuation that they would grandfather them. So, you know, they're not going.
Meaning what?
Well, they won't go back retrospectively and change what people have already done or have that influence it. But this was one of the things where they've said, well, it is retrospective. You're looking backwards at what people have done to date within the rules, and that will now affect what they're doing going forward. And it was really quite a big change, because if you think about it, if you already had a strategy in place that involved adding money into your super.
Yeah.
Let's say you sold an investment property because you're about to retire and that's what you were going to be living off.
Mm-hmm.
Potentially that could throw a lot of plans out the window.
And super was really a relatively safe place to keep your savings and not have to pay too much tax.
Right. Well, it's a tax structure, not a safe place as far as the investments go. Mm-hmm. I mean, investments no matter where it is.
As safe as you decide you want it to be, basically, you know, because I think that's we hear that a lot commented on, you know, radio or wherever, that super's good or super's bad, but that comment is really, I mean, it doesn't make sense, because you put your money into super, the reason some people get disappointed and it doesn't turn out the way they had hoped is that they then invest in just the default option that they're, you know, that they've signed up to, and they don't really know what they're going into, and often that involves a lot of money in shares, and maybe that's not what you're comfortable with. So that's where people need to take a little bit of interest, and if you want it to be safe and secure, then choose an option that is safe and secure, which might be cash or a term deposit.
So all super funds give you these options?
No.
No.
And that's why, again, you need to take that interest or get some advice on, mm-hmm. well, which fund offers what I need? You know, do I need hundreds and hundreds of options available to me, or am I fine getting away with the half a dozen that a more basic fund offers me? Because typically a basic fund, if it has half a dozen options, that might involve cash at one extreme and a share fund at the other. Whereas a more comprehensive fund, it won't just be a cash option. They'll probably have six different cash options plus term deposits like you would get if you walked into your local bank, and maybe a whole lot of other fixed interest or bond funds that try to do a little bit better but could also do a little bit worse. And then you have to, I guess, either be wise enough and do your own research or get some advice to know what to mix together and which ones to choose when.
Is being a provider of super or manager of other people's super funds like being a bookmaker where you can hardly lose?
I don't know. Can all bookmakers hardly lose? I'm not sure.
And you need
that
a license to do this? I mean, I can't suddenly start up, you know, I will manage your super.
No, you need a license.
You need a license.
Absolutely. Yeah. And super is pretty heavily regulated. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're a provider, you've got to have all sorts of trustee relationships and custodial mm-hmm. relationships to make sure that the assets are held separately from you as the manager, I mm-hmm. guess, so yeah. that if you fall over, people then don't lose their money because that's held separately in trust for you as the beneficiary mm-hmm. of your own super fund.
It's a good distinction to make for people. If you've got a self-managed superannuation fund and you go out and buy investments through that, keep in mind that those investments are not subject to the same regulation that a normal superannuation fund is subject to.
Yeah.
And we saw through the GFC, one example that springs to mind is a investment company called Trio Capital. There are a lot of investors in there who lost some, if not all, of their investment. People who had invested that through ordinary super, so super funds who had put that investment in their portfolio actually were compensated for their loss, whereas self-managed super fund investors were not. So just a bit of a word of warning for people with self-managed superannuation funds, you are the trustee of that fund and you need to, I guess, take on that responsibility of that due diligence and make sure that that investment stacks up, because you're not getting that advantage of having a separate trustee look after that side of things for you.
I've seen a case recently with a client who's come to me who, you know, the victim of a fraud,
mm.
and they're running this investment through their self-managed super fund and they're looking for someone to blame. And the problem for them is, well, the only people to blame really are themselves because they're the trustee of their own super fund, even though that they would like to blame, you know, an accountant or somebody else that signed off on the books. At the end of the day, they're legally responsible. Mm. So, yeah, like Carly said, there can be some merit to involving a larger group or corporation where you get some protection by having their involvement.
It's said that a very large percentage of small businesses fail in the first couple of years.
Mm.
Is this because advice on how to do it properly is just not available and people leap into it? As soon as they've got a few bob, they think, let's open up a shop, let's open a restaurant, we'll make a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, look, not always. I mean, there's so many different reasons. And first up, I mean, it's a big risk anyway. Not every small business is going to work. You just have to walk down any street to see empty shops. Depends on the business, but I mean, you've got problems. You know, a lot of those businesses, restaurants are extremely expensive to start up. You've got a lot of infrastructure that you need. You've got staffing requirements. You've got produce that you need to stock. And you've got a lot of outlay before you're actually getting any money in.
Mm-hmm.
Potentially inexperience. For some people, they could have a great business but simply not have enough cash flow just to get them through that initial period where they need to be reinvesting their money back into the business. They might not just be able to last long enough to get it going.
Mm-hmm.
Potentially not being able to secure finance, depending on the risk associated. So there's so many, I guess, risks that people face taking on this new venture. Certainly if you can make a go of it, the rewards can be immense. But
I think that's the key point. A small business can be the most rewarding investment you'll ever make. But like anything, it's this whole trade-off between risk and reward. So the upside can be huge, but so can the downside. And like any investment, the more something can go up, the more it can go down as well. And a small business is no different to that. But if you get it right, obviously that's the way people will make most money. You know, far more than, I think, investing just in shares or property, which are, I mean, they're passive investments. You don't have to do anything. Mm. It's all managed for you.
Mm.
But you probably do have some kind of limited upside because you're effectively outsourcing the management of that entire business that you've invested into.
Mm.
Whereas with a small business, if you do it right, you get all the profits to yourself. So, I mean, we talk about on this show financial planning and advice and looking after your finances, and really small business owners should be doing exactly the same for their own businesses. And generally that might come via an accountant.
Mm.
People getting more serious might get some kind of business coach, and it may even be just mentorship, more than anything financial, just giving people guidelines on how to operate and behave when you run a business.
That's a big one, because I mean, if you start up a business, start up a restaurant, you may be an amazing chef but have no idea how to run a business or what your obligations are. So getting the right people involved doing the right things is really important. Don't assume that you can take on every single role that business is going to require.
And there are rumors that if it's a shopfront thing, if it's really successful, there will be people running protection records.
Oh.
Pay us so much a week and your windows won't be broken. There are some towns where every shop has to pay protection.
Sounds like an Italian mafia scenario.
Movie.
Well, not just mafia, but I think all races are involved in this.
Mm. I'm certain it does occur.
You'd think the insurance
scary.
Companies would know something about this.
Or window companies. Maybe go into windows.
Invest in glass companies. And you're on top of the pyramid then, aren't you? Wow. I'm glad I'm not investing in a small business. But pensions, more my style. I plan to make money out of pensions. So my ambition was to become a pensioner, and it's just around the corner. But 1st of January next year, new rules.
Mm.
New asset rules, new penalties for having too much money.
Well, I guess less benefits. And they estimated that 90,000 people are going to lose entitlements to the age pension come 1 January. So that's a big lot of people that will no longer receive any benefits. Keep in mind, even if those people are getting $5 a fortnight, the associated benefits of being a pensioner will also be lost. Worth mentioning, those people...
And that's worth, what, $4,000 a year?
Yeah, they say about $4,000 to $6,000 if you're using them all. Mm. So that's things like no car registration and things like that. Mm. Those people will apparently be moved over automatically onto the Commonwealth Seniors Healthcare Card.
Mm-hmm.
They will still retain some of the health benefits, not all of the health benefits, but a lot of them. So, I mean, that's a good, silver lining for those people. But... I mean, the biggest impacted are going to be people who are getting quite a reasonable-sized age pension and using that to supplement their retirement and to find that either lost or significantly decreased come 1 January means that money has to then come from somewhere else.
And the amounts we're talking about for a couple who own their own home, they could lose, $10,000 plus a year under the new system. So it's not an insignificant...
Because of having more assets than they allow.
Yeah.
And at the moment, it's around 800... No, it's 1.1 million, isn't it? It comes down to 800 and something.
That's right, 1.17 million, dropping down to 823 for a homeowner couple, and for single homeowners, going from 788,000 down to 543.
Right.
So, and I guess we're not saying that those people can't afford to survive. They can. It just means you're going to be forced to eat into your own assets much quicker.
And if they want to bring the assets down legally, they can pay for improvements to the house.
Yes.
Yep.
What about buying a carpet? Is that house improvement?
Yep.
If it's
buying a television set, is that home improvement?
Yep.
Buying
a
camera.
Keep in mind, they still count your contents as an asset, but look, a television set really shouldn't make a big difference, depending on what you're buying, but it shouldn't make a big difference to your contents value. Look, most people's contents are valued around about the $5,000 mark.
Really?
I think first step, people should look at what Centrelink are already listing for their assets, so they might have their car at a certain asset value. They haven't updated Centrelink for 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
It could be worth significantly less, or Centrelink might be valuing bank accounts that they no longer have or whatever. So make sure that what information there is right before you go and start spending money. The other thing is, unless you're sort of borderline, I mean, don't go out and spend a whole lot of money that you weren't going to spend anyway, because, you know, at the end of the day, you're better having that money in your bank account and using it to live off than just spending it for the sake of it. You'd have to spend a lot of money to make a significant difference to your income. So
if you're at the margins, though, where timing can come into it might be, say, with gifting. You know, let's say you were just $10,000 or $20,000 above the threshold, and sneaking under gives you these benefits of, you know, $4,000 to $6,000 that we're talking about. That's where you might bring forward some of that gifting, because it's done based on financial years. So you could technically give away $10,000 today and then another $10,000 on the 1st of July.
Oh, really?
And Centrelink won't count those assets. So we're coming to the end of the financial year now, and so people do need to think about, well, what situation am I in? How am I going to be affected? And should I be bringing forward any of these strategies before the end of June? Because once we tick over that date, you're a year behind the eight ball. But the other thing I see is, I mean, I had a lovely client in today. He's entitled to more age pension, but he just can't be bothered updating Centrelink because he finds it quite daunting to get in there. He doesn't know how to log into the MyGov website. He doesn't want to queue up down at Centrelink and feel like he's, you know, begging. And so they count an extra $50,000 worth of assets that he doesn't actually have.
Can he employ you to do it for him?
Yeah, he could.
Or his solicitor or accountant or whatever.
He could. He could sign over some kind of authority for us to act on his behalf. But, yeah, bottom line for him is that it's a hassle and he's willing just to sit there and not worry about it because he's surviving anyway, which is very generous of him to the government, I think. But for a lot of people out there, it pays just to ask Centrelink, well, what are you counting? You know, what's on record that as far as my assets go, and do a cross-check? You know, are they up to speed or not? And make sure that you're benefiting as much as you can be, because that might compensate you for a lot of the changes due to kick in come January.
Now, as people approach pension age and they're doing their forward planning, which they should do, they might be thinking, well, I can't afford the full hospital and medical benefits cover.
Yep.
And if they just drop that, they're still covered, aren't they?
Well, they're covered under the public system.
Yes.
So if they drop their private health, they're still covered under public.
They get to the end of a long queue then.
Yes. Yeah, and this is the thing, and I think, I mean, I speak to clients quite a lot about this because it's definitely something that people think about in retirement, should they keep it up. I guess the problem is once you hit retirement is when you're more likely to be using it. The thing, look, if the feedback I've had is if it tends to be something like cancer or something like that, you're going to get into hospital, you're going to get the treatment you need. You may not get to pick your specific doctor, but you're going to get treated, you know, by the best facilities, you know, good doctors. The issues come in with things like knee replacements and things that are apparently considered elective, even when you can't walk.
Yeah.
We know of someone who recently did that, paid for it themselves, and spent, I think, over $40,000to get a knee replacement, where realistically they couldn't have continued working or even really living any sort of quality of life without getting it done. The thought of waiting 18 months on the public system was just too much. It's a catch-22,
isn't it? Even though they couldn't work without having it done, it wasn't tax-deductible?
No. Good point, though.
Wow.
But I have clients come in where, you know, maybe living modestly in retirement, they might be spending $40,000 a year as a couple, and yet they're spending, you know, over $4,000 a year on the health insurance.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about spending over 10% of your income every year just for that insurance, I can see why some people say, is there another way? You know, should I just rely on the public system?
Is there a sliding scale of covers where you can say, look, I don't want to be insured against being trampled by elephants or taken by crocodiles, but I do want to insure against this, this, and this?
You definitely look at it, and this is what I say to people, oh, look at your cover and, you know, get some alternate quotes. I tried to do that for my own cover recently, and quite honestly, I gave up eventually because it comes back down to it, and when they start listing off all the things you could drop that would affect your price, you're like, oh, no, maybe not that. Oh, no, I better not drop that. And it feels a bit like a gamble.
You think as soon as I drop it.
Yeah, exactly.
But if you're 85, you probably don't need obstetrics and things like that. So,
right,
you know, you could remove those items. But I think you're then playing at the margins, and you know, it drops your cost from 4,000 to 3,950, and it's okay. It's a bit of a saving, but it's not making the difference.
Sometimes it's not worth the paperwork, as you were saying about the chap with the pension.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, we'll take a break and be right back. 131873. If our listeners have any questions about matters to do with finance, superannuation, pensions, and so on, 131873. 10:30 to 1 on. The bottom line, 131873. If you have any questions, if you haven't fully got on top of all your financial future plans, then get some free advice right now. All caretaker, no responsibility, except by management, staff, and special guests. The program is for educational purposes. 131873. Now, we've got some cool, wet weather for the next week. Today, the city temperature will be 19 degrees, the same in the west. The overnight minimum, 11 in the city, 7 in the west. And around about 80% chance of rain, a higher chance of rain on the coastal fringe. That goes up to 90%. Tomorrow will be the first day of winter, Wednesday, June the 1st, 13 to 18 degrees, 90% chance of rain. Up to 19 on Thursday with a 70% chance of rain. 19 again on Friday and Saturday. And a likelihood of rain, and on Sunday a top of 21, you'll think it's summer, and a 70% chance of rain. Now, do you believe we're in for more interest rate cuts? And if you do, why? How do we know? How can we tell in advance?
I'm going to say yes. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go with the majority. So the majority do say yes, we'll probably see another one this year and another one next year. Mm-hmm. Some people, I think even the Commonwealth Bank, are saying they think we'll see two more this year. So I think the general consensus is yes, we will see them, just when they occur and how many more there are to go. Look, already down at 1.75, we can't have too many more to go anyway. But
are these record lows at the moment?
Yeah, well, back to 1950s. So 1950s was the last time we saw the rates this low. So, yeah, I mean, it's pretty significant to be back back this low again. And, yeah, certainly no relief for cash holders in the near future.
But your question on how can you tell, I mean, a couple of ways. One would be have a look what the banks are offering on their fixed rate loans over the next year or two, because if that's lower than the current variable rate, then the bank is factoring in that interest rates will fall. So that's one indicator. Another, and this is probably a little more complicated, but you can have a look at the bond markets. You know, what is a 1 year, 2 year, 3 year bond being priced at? And if it's at a lower rate, then okay, bond markets are predicting that rates will fall. And the bond market tends to be a very efficient predictor of what's happening with interest rates. The share market, less so. It tends to react more in the short term, maybe, you know, maybe a 6 to 12 month period, and it reacts in quite a volatile way. So it's a little harder to read interest rates off the back of the share market.
But the good news is that we're going back to the 50s and 60s, and you can get money back on your bottles now, apparently. Has that kicked in yet?
I thought that was only in South Australia.
It was, yes. But they're considering doing it in New South Wales.
Oh, great. I didn't know that.
I'll do that up at the local footy game again.
Get the kids like back out.
So I can go back to being a beachcomber, my chosen profession, actually, and the bottom fell out
with the metal detector. And
it was, when was it? It was in the late 60s, I think. They canned the idea, if I can use that expression. We couldn't get the money back anymore.
That was a sad day when it stopped, I think. I used to love that as a kid.
I was going to say, I'm sure they still had it when we were kids. I remember the cans in big bags.
We must take a break. We'll be back in a moment. 4:30 to 1 on 2GB. As the hour draws to a close, what haven't we discussed that we should have discussed?
I'm sure something will
crop up.
Ticked
all the boxes.
We've got through a fair bit tonight, I think. A lot of topics. One thing that I think when we're talking to Jim, he was talking about, you know, market trading systems being a scam. And we did want to talk briefly about scams tonight, because we are seeing some of that even coming through our office with people, you know, trying to fraudulently get money out of other people's super funds and change bank accounts without people being aware and siphon off money. So I guess the warning for listeners would be just be wary of this kind of thing, because it's happening. And it's very hard to control on your own end. But if you're dealing with an advisor or someone like that, you know, maybe you give them the instruction, look, unless I call you personally, assume that it's not me, you know.
Right. Oh, I see, pretending to be someone. And
absolutely.
We've got, yeah, so email addresses being hijacked and sending advisors emails requesting, you know, money on your behalf. So, yeah, and look, a lot of these scams, so those ones and plus the other investment scams we see, which really investment scams account for most of the money lost to scams anyway, is a lot of them are so sophisticated. It would be very difficult to distinguish a legitimate investment. Look, general rule of thumb, if it's unsolicited, somebody's selling you something, stay well away from it and don't send money overseas.
Yep, and if they keep coming back to you for more payments, it's a clear sign that something is not right. And if you can't get any other research on whatever they're providing or suggesting from an external research provider, then steer clear of it. It's just not worth it.
And those who want to know more about IT Financial Services can go to the website itfs.com.au or call them during business hours here in Sydney on 9258 7500. They're Australia's own high-quality financial planning company. The number again, you should write it down, 9258 7500. Now, this could make a huge difference to your financial future. IT Financial Services, 9258 7500. 1 minute to one. Time has gone so fast.
Because
we've been busy, we've been having fun.
And we have been having fun.
Well, it's always fun. Thank you very much to both of you.
Thank you, Brian.
And we'll see
me next week,
one or both of you. Same time, same station next week.
Look forward to it.
Bye for now.